Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Donald Trump promised and is moving forward with deportations of those he says are gang members and who are in the country illegally. In March, the Trump administration sent hundreds of immigrants to El Salvador's Cicat mega prison, including over 200 Venezuelan nationals who were alleged to have gang ties. The U.S. is paying El Salvador $6 million to house those men. The case of Kilmar Abrego Garcia has been in the news a lot of late. The Trump administration admits Garcia was mistakenly deported, and the U.S. Supreme Court has ordered the government to facilitate his release. So far, the Trump White House has not responded to the High Court. Attorney General Pam Bondi has effectively said his release would be up to El Salvador, but the case has raised furor over possible human rights and constitutional violations, and Trump was caught on an open mic recently talking about moving convicted American prisoners to that jail. Garcia's case is not unique. There are others, including that of one man living in the Charlotte area. Julio Zambrano Perez was detained by ICE following a routine check-in appointment. It happened shortly before his wife gave birth to their second child. ICE allegedly misidentified him as a gang member because of his tattoos. The story of his immigration to this country, his apprehension and imprisonment, was recently chronicled by Mother Jones. Reporter Isabella Diaz joins us for the hour to share that story and also with us to talk about that and other aspects of this administration's approach to deportations is Jamila Espinosa. She is an immigration attorney with Espinosa Law. Welcome to you both. Good morning.
Good morning.
Isabella, good morning. Isabella, I'm going to start with you. Julio Zambrano Perez was detained by ICE in February and was sent in March along with these 260 other men, 238 of which were Venezuelan, to El Salvador's mega prison Cicat, which is a terrorism confinement center. He is there along with the man I spoke of a moment ago, Kilmar Abrego Garcia. It is Mr. Abrego who has received all of the attention. Outside of Mother Jones, we haven't heard about Mr. Zambrano. So how did you find his story?
So my colleague Noah Lennard and I started looking, searching for cases of men who whose families thought had been sent to El Salvador on Saturday, March 15th, right after there were news that this deportation planes had landed in El Salvador, and then it was unclear at the time who had been put on those planes and under which, you know, what were the allegations or any evidence that supported accusations that they were gang members. And so we started looking through social media, and it didn't take long for us to find, you know, videos and posts on Facebook and even TikTok of family members in Venezuela, you know, looking for any information about their relatives and their loved ones. You know, these were people who thought that their sons, their brothers, you know, their husbands were going to be returned to Venezuela. In many cases, they had called their loved ones, you know, from a detention center in Texas just the day before on Friday, March 14th, to say, you know, we are being deported, I'll see you soon. And this man never arrived back in Venezuela. Instead, as we know now, they had been sent directly to this mega prison in El Salvador, where they have been held now for weeks incommunicado.
And since reporters and attorneys and family members have not been able to talk to these men who were deported and put into Cicat, that prison in El Salvador, do we know for a fact that Julio Zambrano Perez is in that prison?
We know that he is most likely there based on this list that CBS News obtained on March 20th. It's an internal U.S. document with the list, you know, the names of the 238 men who were sent to Cicat. And Julio Zambrano Perez's name is in there, and that's how his family after scrambling to find any information about him, they couldn't, unlike other families, they couldn't identify him from photos or, you know, frames from the videos that the Salvadorian government has been advertising of this man in prison. So the only certainty they have is based on that list. But still, when I talked to the family, they were like, you know, we don't know for sure. We can't know for sure because we just haven't heard anything about him.
So here's the local tie to this. Mr. Zambrano was living in the Davidson area. I'm just curious about his country of origin because his route to the United States was circuitous. We were not the first country of his choice to come to after feeling the need to leave his native land. So what was his country of origin and where else has he and his family been prior to coming here?
So Julio left Venezuela. He's originally from Maracay. This is a city in the state of Aragua in northern Venezuela. He left in 2018. You know, Venezuela, of course, for years now has been suffering a historic economic collapse and, you know, just a chaotic, political situation for many years now. And that has prompted thousands of Venezuelans to leave the country, including Julio. So he first went to Peru, where he met Luz, his wife. You know, they had their first daughter there. But soon after, you know, they were there for a few years, but then they started being, you know, subject to extortion. They had this little plot of land and that kind of that created a situation where they were being extorted for money, didn't feel safe. They moved then after a few years to Chile, where again, were experiencing, you know, violence and just didn't feel safe in Chile either. They were there for 8 or so months. And then, you know, in order to protect themselves and their daughter, they decided to move north and come to the United States, where, you know, they had relatives in North Carolina. So they settled in Davidson.
So they made that very dangerous trek through the jungles of Central America, through Colombia and Panama, and reached Mexico. And in 2023, they surrendered to the U.S. Border Patrol and were given a notice. They wanted asylum, and they were given a notice to appear before an immigration judge in February of 2027. That's 5 years from their arrival time. To be clear, under our laws, correct me if I'm wrong, Jamila, under our laws, they were here legally awaiting a hearing. Why does it take so long?
Correct. It takes so long because the immigration system, we talk about this often, is quite broken. The lack of resources that has been allocated to the immigration courts, to the Department of Homeland Security. Right now, in throughout the nation, we have about 4 million pending cases. Here in Charlotte, we're at over 145,000 cases. Charlotte itself has 5 judges. They have created a new system in which they have virtual judges hearing cases in Richmond, Virginia, and throughout the nation. But that just shows you, those figures show you the extent of the backlog. The administration, upon arriving, the Trump administration terminated, I think, about over 13 immigration judges. So considering this backlog, terminating even one immigration judge, let alone 13, is going to continue to add to these backlogs.
A lot of things that the Trump administration is doing appear to be, on the surface, from those of us who can only read about it in the newspaper or hear about it on television or radio, seem to be at cross purposes. They want to achieve goal X, but they do something that makes goal X unachievable. Do you think this is purposeful? Are they purposefully crippling the immigration system even more than it already is?
Yeah, I mean, I think the things that we've seen happen within the last few weeks, in which they have canceled people's legal status that arrived to the United States legally under certain programs through the Biden administration, and they sought to cancel it. There's several injunctions that are putting those on hold, also trying to end temporary protective status. That would increase the backlog by over 1 million additional people. So when you consider them trying to enforce what they say the illegal migration, but then trying to strip away those that have legal status, I think it is purposeful. And the panorama really is that they're going after all migration, both legal and illegal migration.
So, Isabella, Mr. Zambrano and his family were seeking asylum in our country. But here's a question I don't think I've ever heard asked, so I will ask it of you. Aside from the desire that many people have who are coming here from elsewhere, from dire conditions and making very dangerous trips to get here, aside from that, and their desire to live in the United States, why don't they stay in Mexico? Why don't they stay in other places in Central and even Northern South America? Why do they take this dangerous journey to come here?
Yeah, I mean, I think, perhaps the Zambrano Perez family answers that to a certain extent. The idea that they had to move from country to country. They tried, right? They tried in Peru, but they were also they are targeted, by criminal organizations. And then again in Chile, he was working as a deliver, for a delivery truck company, and would be his wife told me that he would be constantly, robbed. And at some point, they felt like they had no option. So I feel like, this migration is it's a global thing, right? It's something that impacts the entire region, and of course it has effects on the United States as well.
So the fact that he was being extorted during his time in Peru and other places in South America, was that the reason that they granted him asylum, that they felt that that was a legitimate situation and he deserved at least a hearing into his claim of asylum?
So, as far as I understand, I believe their asylum claim is based on their fear of having been targeted by gangs. But they didn't really have the opportunity, or at least Julio hasn't had the opportunity to go before the judge and make the case because he's now stuck in El Salvador.
And his case, when he came in 2023, as we said, he was scheduled for a court appearance in 2027. I want to remind people that it's still 2025. So that's 2 years away, or at least a year and a half away. He was detained, however, during a routine check-in. Evidently, people have to come in and check in with immigration from time to time. And they detained him and sent him to this prison in El Salvador. On what grounds?
So I think it's important to keep in mind that Julio was doing everything he was supposed to do, right? He sought asylum, him and his family. He obtained a work authorization. He had a social security number, which meant that he was probably paying taxes. He had a state ID. He had no criminal record that I could find, except for two very small traffic citations, for driving without a license, which was right before, right after he arrived to North Carolina. And yeah, so he had to, routinely check in with ICE, and they were doing that. So they had no reason to believe that on January 29th, when they went, at 5 a.m. in the morning, when they went to the Charlotte ICE office, that they had anything to fear. They had done that before. And instead they decided on that day to hold him. They held him for hours. Luz was with her daughter. She was about, 7 days from giving birth to their second daughter, who Julio has not met in person, only through video calls until this day. And yeah, they held him back. They told her that they were gonna investigate him for his tattoos.
And his is not the only case in which someone reporting for a routine check-in with immigration has been detained and/or deported. And we'll talk about that and the fears that that is raising in the community, perhaps deliberately, when we come back from the break. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the problems with the immigration system, particularly with regard to the deportations of some 200-plus men to El Salvador, among them Julio Zambrano Perez, who was a resident of Davidson. His story is not getting the kind of coverage that Kilmer Abrego Garcia's is, but it's similar in almost every aspect, and it's chronicled in Mother Jones by our guest today, Isabella Diaz, who's a reporter who's written extensively about these situations in Mother Jones. Also with us, Jamila Espinosa, an immigration attorney with Espinosa Law. And Jamila, his, as I said, is not the only case of being coming to a check-in by law, doing what's right, and then being detained and deported. CBS News reported on Monday on a Palestinian who had applied for citizenship, waited for a year to get his appointment. The appointment came just recently, and he was suspicious of it, and he had a right to be, because when he went into that appointment, ICE apprehended him, and his situation now is up in the air. So these deportations, and just the idea that these folks have to check in periodically, are now raising fears throughout the community. What does the added worry about being detained while trying to legally comply with government requirements do to the fear level and to compliance?
Yeah, it absolutely affects people's their frame of reference. Do I comply or not? The numbers show that most migrants that come to the United States that are put in deportation proceedings, the large percent of them, over 80%, present themselves to their deportation hearings. They come here seeking opportunities, seeking asylum, and they want to do right. They want to ensure that they're complying with the laws once they're here. When you go to the Charlotte, local ICE office any day, Monday through Friday, you will see lines, hundreds of people starting at 5 a.m. Because they have those ICE check-in appointments, they want to ensure they're complying. There's not enough appointment slots every day. And so many times they are turned away and they become very fearful if they were giving a specific date and unable to turn. So what's happening is you have people having to decide, do I comply with the law or do I not, and go into the shadows.
What are you advising your clients? I'm sure this has come up in your appointments with them. What are you advising them?
I have to advise them to comply with the law, right? That's what we do as lawyers. We have to ensure that they understand what the law is and that if they do have an ICE check-in appointment, they have to comply with it. But we ensure that they're empowered by having certain documentation, ensuring that they have, for example, if they're on appeal from a deportation order and that case is on appeal, they have evidence of that appeal. But more than anything, trying to instill confidence in them has been hard because the United States has been a country of rule of law and doesn't feel like that very much. So it is very hard to get people to want to comply and tell them that the laws are going to be followed.
And it is not just hearing about these stories of people coming in to comply with the law and then being deported that are raising fear in the community. It's actually emails being sent out by the Department of Homeland Security that telling them to leave the country, essentially. Talk about that, because those emails are causing, as you say, confusion and even more fear.
Yeah, so we saw some emails go out over the last few weeks. Last week was some the larger pool received them, and it was indicating that parole periods, which is a permission that people are granted to enter the United States for a certain period of time, were terminated. You had 7 days to leave the United States, and those notices went to individuals that did have parole, but they also went to U.S. citizens. I have colleagues that received those that are naturalized U.S. citizens. Have been naturalized for decades. So it caused a lot of confusion, a lot of fear. The Department of Homeland Security said in some context it was an error for those that came from Ukraine and were granted parole. It was erroneous. But since then, they haven't really clarified for everyone whether that was an error or not. And we think, honestly, sometimes it may be intentional to stoke that fear so that some individuals do self-deport.
As is the case, Isabella, with the higher profile situation involving Mr. Abrego, no one can reach Zambrano. You write that Mr. Zambrano's wife is at a loss. You quote her as saying, quote, "We don't even know what to do. We don't understand what they are going to do with him. No one answers, not here, not in Venezuela, not anywhere." Is she safe?
It's hard to answer that, objectively these days. I think I imagine that she is not feeling safe, right? She went to the ICE check-in with her husband and saw him being disappeared to a foreign prison. So, yeah, it's, you know, it was so distressing, you know, to kind of hear from her, this experience of having to explain to her, you know, daughter who is almost four, who asks for her father every single day, like, you know, where is my dad? Doesn't he love me anymore? Why doesn't he come home? And all Luz, his husband, his wife can say is, you know, he will be back. He might not be next week, but he will come back. He's just working. But again, she doesn't know if he's gonna come back, right?
And this is not the only case where the wife and sometimes the children, and in this case she had her daughter with her, were at the ICE facility with her husband. He was detained, she was not. And that has been the case in almost every case. Why? Are they just targeting the men?
You know what? The 238, you know, men who were sent to El Salvador, they were all young men, and it seems like there is a pattern that has emerged where a lot of them seem to have tattoos, and the tattoos were the, you know, the basis for the claim that they are supposed members of the Venezuelan organized group, crime group, Tren de Aragua. In Julio's case, he has a tattoo of a crown with his name, Julio, on it, and he has this rose with, you know, $100 pattern, bill petals, you know, tattoos that he got when he was like 15. And again, his family has been adamant that he had no ties to Tren de Aragua, and they suspect that it's the tattoos and the fact that he was born in the state of Aragua, which again, you know, you could hardly claim that everyone from that place or who has commonplace tattoos that, you know, one lawyer told me you could find, you know, a tattoo of a rose, a tattoo of a clock, a tattoo of a, you know, the Chicago Bulls or what have you in any coffee shop in America, right? And we know that they have been using this kind of validation guide. You know, ICE gives, you know, attributes like 4 points to someone for having a tattoo, and that can add up. If it adds up to 8 points, they would be deemed, you know, deportable under the Alien Enemies Act.
It makes you wonder if they've been to a rock concert recently. For those who have not been following this closely, Tren de Aragua is the alleged gang that these people are alleged to be members of, and the United States has deemed that a terrorist organization. If we have time, we'll talk about the veracity of that claim a little while from now. Jamila, some of the men deported in March to El Salvador had pending asylum cases in this country. What are the laws governing what must happen here when a person applies for asylum? And in Mr. Zambrano's case, he applied, they granted it, they've set him a court date in February of 2027. What are the laws? What is the process? What process must be followed? And are there international law implications to not
Yeah.
following those laws on our part?
Absolutely. So for in his case, you know, there is due process, which the Supreme Court touched on. We talked a little bit about Abrego Garcia and these men as well. The Supreme Court has touched on is that they still have due process rights, and they have to be given an opportunity to be heard. And in Mr. Zambrano Perez's case, he had a pending hearing. That was the next step. So he had filed his asylum application, and an immigration judge was then supposed to hear at his hearing in 2027 his claim. And at that point, he would be able to present any evidence, any testimony, any witnesses. And that judge would then be the adjudicator on whether he would grant him asylum or not. And if he was not granted asylum, this is very important for people to understand, that doesn't end it. He would have a 30-day deadline to be able to appeal that to the Board of Immigration Appeals. This is how the laws are written. This is how Congress has written the laws, so that everyone in the United States has due process rights. And that's the issue that the Supreme Court has ruled on, is they still have to have an opportunity to be able to bring their claims.
This is really important. We have a constitution in this country, the 14th Amendment of which says the government cannot deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. It is there in that document, something that we have abided by for over 200 years, because the British would do exactly that, and we didn't want a repeat of that under our system of government. And the Supreme Court has said This amendment applies to undocumented immigrants. So, in this country, legally or not, there is no way to sugarcoat this. This is the action of a dictator. This is the action of an authoritarian regime, and our constitutional protections against this activity, which have been in place since the founding of the Republic, are being tested. So as a lawyer, how can this happen without due process? Does the Trump administration, the DOJ, or ICE have a leg to stand on here?
You know, I think you and I had talked a little bit about the Alien Enemies Act right after the inauguration, and I really didn't foresee that it had only been used in time of war. The Supreme Court is leaving things pretty vague when they are on these rulings. Right now, it's still, you know, going to have to be seen exactly on what they do in regards to Mr. Obrego Garcia, and that the president and his administration have made it really clear that they are not going to work to bring him back, even though the Supreme Court ruled that they would needed to work on facilitating his return. So I think that is something that will be seen. My hope is that the Supreme Court will come back, because that is the avenue right now that the administration continues to go to. They continue to seek, you know, relief through the Supreme Court, because the president believes that that is where he has favor. Something that, you know, many people ask me, why does this matter to U.S. citizens, for example? Why does Mr. Obrego Garcia, he was here in the United States without legal status anyways. He was from El Salvador. Why should this matter? Because the president himself has said he likes the idea of possibly sending U.S. citizens to Cenote, to this prison, which we've seen is ripe with human rights issues. Never in our history have we ever seen an administration say that they would consider sending American citizens to another country.
And that too would be unconstitutional.
Absolutely, would be unconstitutional. And that's where the due process rights of one individual, whether they're undocumented or not, being violated, can affect us all. Every U.S. citizen could be affected if this is allowed to happen.
So Ty Cobb, who served as White House special counsel during the first Trump administration, says that in Trump 2.0, quote, they don't believe in the authority of the courts. They believe in their own implied powers, which are implied not by anything legal, but just in their own minds and their own egos. Are they deliberately trying to change our form of government? And if they are not met with resistance that forces them to follow our laws, will they have succeeded in forming a new type of government in this country?
I believe so. And that's why I think the challenges, you know, sometimes people ask, well, why do the lawyers keep filing lawsuits? Very similar, because that's the only way that we're going to be able to ensure that, you know, our laws are respected. Right now, we do have Judge Boasberg, who has said there's been probable cause for criminal contempt against administration officials. That's unprecedented. We've never seen that happen to that level. But I think it's those challenges that are going to have to happen for us to be able to stand firm against this administration's tactics.
Pam Bondi's Department of Justice has characterized the Supreme Court's ruling in the Kilmer Obrego Garcia case as, quote, an affront to Trump's authority. But court rulings on actions taken under our laws, as prescribed by the Constitution and by passed and signed into law by Congress and previous presidents, that is how our system works. And if Trump continues to defy the court, and the court has very little recourse, they can't do very much if you defy them, particularly if the levers of justice are controlled by the executive branch. In other words, the U.S. Marshals, et cetera, they're not going to deploy the U.S. Marshals to arrest people in the executive branch when the executive branch is ignoring the law. If Trump continues to defy the court, can we officially term this, you're the lawyer here, as a lawless administration? Have we seen the end of rule of law? And if this administration refuses to follow the Constitution, can we consider this to be a legitimate government?
I think we're definitely in that parameter, right? We are already seeing them test the limits of defying the court orders. They're playing the semantics of facilitate versus effectuate. And so I think if they continue to defy the Supreme Court or any court orders, we are looking at a government that has decided that they're going to play by their own rules. And we're definitely not looking at the United States that you and I, or most Americans are used to seeing. We're not living, going to be living in a democracy, because we are living by standards that they set. Not by Congress.
Isabella, both the El Salvadoran president and Donald Trump insist that they cannot return these individuals that have been imprisoned, particularly in, this is coming down in the case of Kilmer Abrego Garcia. Has anybody talked to the government about Julio Zambrano Perez? Have there been any efforts to get him released? And if not, why not?
Yeah, I mean, as far as I'm aware, and in my conversations with his family, there hasn't been any, no one has reached out to them. They are really at a loss of what they can do. His sisters who are in North Carolina said, that it would be really hard for them to even afford a lawyer if it came to that. We know from recent reporting that that no one has been able to reach the man, including lawyers from the Venezuelan government.
I have a question for the attorney here. I mean, I know that lawyers are in the business to make money, although they do take pro bono cases, but we have a tax now on our system of government by the government itself. We have law firm, big law firms capitulating to threats from the Trump administration. Why? Why aren't these people lining up to defend all 260 plus people who have been sent to El Salvador and challenge the government on its illegal motions?
It's a great point, and it's really disappointing. I saw yesterday that now some of these law firms, and some law firms have decided, we're not going to capitulate to the administration. We're going to fight back. We're going to file our lawsuits. But those that decided that they were going to, offer millions of dollars in services to the administration, they now find themselves losing clients. They now find themselves doing work that they never thought that they would have to do, work that has to do with tariffs. And so we do see now these law firms that decided, hey, we're going to comply with the administration instead of fighting back and doing what's right, be affected as well.
Jamila Espinosa is an immigration attorney here in the Charlotte area with Espinosa Law. Isabella Diaz is with us. She's a reporter for Mother Jones who has written extensively about the Davidson resident who has been deported. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Our New South. This Charlotte-based Levine Museum podcast explores today's South through social, political, and cultural topics in their historical context, featuring conversations with locals driving change. Our New South is available on all podcast platforms.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the case of Julio Zambrano Perez, the Davidson resident who was recently swept up in those deportations of about 260 other people and sent to a prison in El Salvador. His case was extensively reported on by Isabella Diaz, one of our guests. She's a reporter for Mother Jones. And Jamila Espinosa is an immigration attorney with Espinosa Law. Before we move on to other things, we have a lot of topics to cover in the next 15 minutes or so. But I want to get a clear understanding, Jamila. Are these claims by the president of his inability to force Venezuela to release any prisoner that we request the release of, prisoners for whom we are paying the bill for them to be housed in Venezuela, do these claims hold even a scintilla of truth, or is this just another of the innumerable lies spread by Donald Trump and his administration on an hourly basis?
Yeah, it's absolutely not true. We have contracted out to the El Salvadorian government to hold these prisoners. We're paying them $6 million initially, right? We don't know how much that's going to go up. There is no timetable for how long these men will be detained. So we don't know how much taxpayers will be funding this. That's also something that I think the public should really understand. He absolutely has the ability. The US government has the ability to ask the president of El Salvador to release Venezuelan citizens that are in their custody. They're not citizens of El Salvador, they're citizens of Venezuela. And we are paying for them to be in El Salvador.
Isabella.
Yeah, I just wanted to, you know, there's so many parts of the administration's arguments that are just disingenuous, right? And doesn't hold up. He on Monday, Donald Trump was sitting next to Nayib Bukele, the Salvadoran president, who very much has, he said he didn't have the power to smuggle, you know, quote, smuggle, again, quote, terrorists into the United States. But that is hardly, you know, what would need to happen. You know, we are talking about two leaders of governments that have an agreement that the administration has been resisting making public, claiming, you know, it's classified and kind of a state secret.
Jamila.
And I think something that's very important to note, when these planes went to El Salvador, there were about seven, I think 7 to 8 females, Venezuelan females, and a Nicaraguan man. The Salvadorian government did not want to take females, and they did not want to take another gentleman from a country from Central America in which they have relationship with. So those individuals were actually returned back to the United States and are back here in the United States. So the idea that the US couldn't receive custody of these individuals is completely false.
There was a person who used the term disappearance on 60 Minutes over the weekend, and one of you has already used it in this conversation. His family calls, Mr. Zambrano's family calls this a forced disappearance. That's a powerful word due to the fact that administrations, lawless dictatorships in Central and South America have disappeared. Their own citizens. They take them off the streets. They're never seen or heard of again. Is that a fair word to use in this case, Jamila, legally?
I think it absolutely is. I mean, you have to consider that they, aside from the last time they were in the United States, all communication with attorneys, consulates, anyone, family members, completely ceased the day that they were taken to El Salvador. We don't even know if Mr. Ivan Obrego Garcia, although the government claims he is safe, we actually don't know. Nobody has laid eyes on him, as well as any of these individuals. None of the families were even notified that they just suspect because CBS received this internal documentation. And so disappeared is absolutely the appropriate word.
So
And
the
again, yeah,
court.
the man thought that they were being sent to Venezuela, right? Like it would not have never occurred to them that they were going to be sent to a third, you know, foreign country that they have never been to before.
So the courts are about a nanosecond away from declaring the Trump administration in contempt of court. We can talk about what that may or may not mean, but the court. They're arguing over two words, essentially, here, because so far the administration has refused to comply with the Supreme Court order, which was a 9-0 decision, which is rare, to facilitate his repatriation. The court stopped short of using the same word that a lower court had used to order his return, which was effectuate. Jamila, what's the difference?
You know, honestly, I don't see much of a difference, but the Supreme Court, I believe, was leaving it up to them to decide how they would work it out between the country of El Salvador, that I believe to facilitate would that they would work, they would make available the resources of the US government so that they then could take custody. I think it's a words and semantics, honestly. I believe at the end of the day, the thought was they needed to work to get him back into the United States.
Isabella.
And, you know, we are seeing the administration really sort of twist the Supreme Court decision to their favor. And in a way, you know, again, like Jamila was saying, like very like a wordplay kind of farce game. You know, you see Stephen Miller, the White House Deputy Chief of Staff for Policy, saying that that was a win for the administration and basically released them from any responsibility to do anything. You know, and that's not true. The Supreme Court, you know, said that they must take steps towards doing something, and that the you know the district court judge needed to sort of you know explain better what effectuate means, but like that the administration is like disingenuously taking that and spinning it in its head and saying, you know, we don't have to do anything, we can't force the hand of a foreign government to you know release someone. We always all our responsibility is only to remove any domestic obstacles. So it really is just this game of like the denial from both parts.
For 250 plus years since the beginning of the Republic, we've had, until January 20th at least, we've had three distinct branches of government, each with their own specific authorities. It is the executive branch job to execute the laws passed by Congress and to spend the money that Congress appropriates on things. They did not appropriate the $6 million for this. The administration did. It is also up to the executive branch to follow court orders coming from courts at all levels, particularly the high court. And yesterday, a judge found probable cause to hold the administration in contempt for ignoring their order to reverse the deportation of Kilmar Abrego Garcia. What does it mean, Jamila, to hold administration officials in contempt? I mean, what exactly is the penalty? Because they can't force the army to come in there and do anything. Since the Supreme Court has given the president immunity, I would imagine he is shielded. Is Donald Trump and the way that he's been approaching the administration of justice through Pam Bondi likely to either just ignore the contempt of court citation if it comes and just pardon anybody who's held in contempt, who's below him?
Yeah, and that's quite possible. You know, Judge Boasberg in this case was the case in which the planes, he wanted more information because he had issued an injunction halting the deportation and ordered the planes in the air to return. And the administration has been very vague on whether they complied with that order or whether they when they knew that information. And so, you know, what is the likeliness of contempt, right? We have criminal contempt, which is usually punitive, jail time, fines. The federal government would indemnify, right, any administration officials that were fined. You have civil contempt, which is usually coercive to try to get you to force you to comply. I think Judge Boasberg has been very patient and very thoughtful in this decision, in that he believes he has to proceed with this to ensure the rule of law. Now, whether contempt charges really will be brought, right, because the president could pardon someone, that is going to be, have to be seen. But I think Judge Boasberg is doing this to ensure that at least the administration is put on notice that when an order by a judge is given, they need to comply.
I want to ask you this question. This question is coming from a listener as we have been talking, and they say this. This is the worst form of fear-mongering. Why don't you tell the truth? This will not affect legal citizens. These are all illegal or criminal immigrants. Can we assume that a lawless administration, one that does not follow the Constitution, would indemnify legal citizens from similar actions? Can we make that leap?
I believe we can. It is not fear mongering when you have, in my office, I receive calls from United States citizens, legal permanent residents, people that have legal status in the United States that are fearful of traveling abroad,
but
because they
that
fear,
fear
that
is
if
that
they
fear
were,
is that fear justified, or is it simply
is.
Because they listen to shows like this, or they watch the television, or they read in the paper, whatever?
Yeah, the fear is justified because we are seeing every day people that are coming into the United States with legal status. They're U.S. citizens, they're green card holders, and they're being detained simply because of their professions, right? So we have lawyers that are being detained so that the administration can review their contact list to try to obtain information from their clients. You have real estate attorneys, not just attorneys in the immigration space. You have individuals who, because of their thought, because of their freedom of speech, are being detained by airport officials for long periods of time. And so I do believe that the fear is a real fear.
You told me before we started the story of an attorney who was coming back into the country, and they detained that attorney, and they were going to continue to detain him if he refused to hand over his phone. Attorneys have to deal with attorney-client privilege. There could be information on that attorney's phone that would violate that privilege if somebody else read the information. Did he surrender his phone? Was it illegal for the government to ask him to without a search warrant, etc.?
Yeah, so in this context, this is a real estate attorney, and he was traveling from Canada back to the United States. He's a US citizen, and his wife is as well, detained at the border and questioned. He really did not understand why. He was questioned for several hours, had a medical emergency, his blood pressure was rising. And they said, "We can take you to the hospital, but it's going to prolong this. If you give us access to your phone, this will be over." And eventually, after citing attorney-client privilege, because of his medical emergency and he wanted to end it, he provided his cell phone. With that consent, yes, they did have the authority to look through it. When you are coming into the United States from international travel, Customs and Border Patrol does have certain abilities, including to see certain information, but not privileged information without your consent. For those privileged information, without your consent, they would need a warrant.
Julian Zambrano Perez has been accused of being a member of the so-called Tren de Aragua gang, which is Train of Aragua. That's a city in Central America. What can you tell us, Isabella, about that organization? Because they have been deemed to be a terrorist organization.
So the Tren de Aragua started in a prison in Venezuela, and it kind of expanded from there. And there is a presence of it across the region and also in the United States, but it is hardly, and this is not me speaking, it's like experts that I have talked to and other reporters have. It hardly amounts to an invasion of the United States, like the Trump administration is claiming and claimed in order to designate it as a foreign terrorist organization and then to invoke the Wartime Alien Enemies Act. Most experts will tell you that Tren de Aragua is this very loosely organized group. There is not a very clear hierarchy to it. And most importantly, perhaps, at least when it comes to the Venezuelans who were sent to El Salvador, tattoos are not a reliable signifier of membership in Tren de Aragua. Tattoos are, not connected to that gang at all. So you can see how relying on tattoos to identify alleged gang members would be hardly a good place to start.
This gang started in a prison in Venezuela. It became Venezuela's largest crime syndicate. It still deals in narco trafficking and human smuggling. The assembly reports that they never dominated Venezuela or competed with cartels outside their home country. And David Smilley at Tulane University calls the idea of them having an organized presence in this country a complete fantasy. But on day one, Donald Trump designated that gang as a foreign terrorist organization which presents, quote, an unusual and extraordinary threat to the national security, foreign policy, and economy of the United States. Again, experts say that is not accurate. They aren't a terrorist organization in the sense that ISIS is one. They have no political or religious agenda, only greed. So there is this official definition of. I guess, is there an official definition, Jamila, of what constitutes a terrorist organization? And if you fit that description, does our country have legal powers that expand as a result?
So the INA, the Immigration and Nationality Act, does articulate foreign terrorist organizations that are designated by the Secretary of State. Tren de Aragua is n activities, as you've articulated, the size of it, the scope, does not match what any of the other organizations that have previously been designated. So when you're looking at organizations like FARC or ISIS, those are the typical organizations that have been designated. The size, the scope, and what the Tren de Aragua was doing does not measure up against any previous foreign terrorist organizations that have been designated under the Secretary of
What are you
State's
advising?
designation.
What are you advising clients in this environment, Jamila? And how might that advice change if the Trump administration refuses to comply with the Supreme Court order?
So
I have less than a minute.
We're advising our clients, continue to appear for their court hearings, to prepare for their court hearings, ensure that they have legal representation. I do a lot of pro bono services in the community, and one of the things that people are lacking is legal representation. Now more than ever, it's paramount that people have legal representation, because doing it alone is just not going to get the results that they need.
This should not be political. I would remind people that this is about one thing and one thing only: the rule of law and following the Constitution. And if we do not follow the rule of law, we do not have the United States of America. And that's all that matters. Isabella Diaz, reporter from Mother Jones, Jamila Espinosa, an immigration attorney with Espinosa Law. Thank you both for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. We have additional production help from Jesse Steinmetz. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.